Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast is called Green Socialist Notes, and it's about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on in 2020. So I think the first thing we need to talk about is this Israeli-Palestinian war. I mean, it's a total catastrophe in Gaza, and there's a lot of violence against Palestinians in the West Bank as well. And I've been saying we need to keep demanding a ceasefire that's permanent and leads to a political process toward resolving the conflict. That seems essential. Ceasefire is just the first step. And I think one of the significant things this week is that Osama Hamdan, who is the senior representative of Hamas in Lebanon, was in an interview and he called for democratic elections as soon as the war ends to establish a legitimate Palestinian government that can negotiate on behalf of the Palestinians. And this is something, you know, I've talked about. There are other Palestinian leaders like Mustafa Barghouti of the Palestinian National Initiative who said the same thing. Now, Hamdan didn't mention proportional representation as I have, but I think the call for elections is significant. Proportional representation, you really want that so that all segments of Palestinian opinion get represented rather than have a plurality winner situation where one faction gets all the power, a winner-take-all situation, which won't be legitimate with the Palestinians or the international community. Hamdan also implied that Hamas would settle for a Palestinian state, a two-state solution, which they've not been clear about, probably still aren't clear about, but he did imply that that would be acceptable. Now, the U.S. this week, you know, delayed negotiating over this U.N. resolution, delayed the humanitarian aid that's so direly needed in Gaza. We spent all week doing that, and then when it came up for a vote, they abstained. It passed 13-0 with two abstentions, the other being Russia. And Russia said they had a problem with the resolution leaving Israeli forces in complete control of the delivery of the humanitarian aid. And I've been very critical about Russia for a lot of things, but they were right about that. But both Russia and the U.S. are hypocrites. You know, Russia opposes settler colonialism in Palestine and does it in Ukraine. And the U.S. opposes it in Ukraine and does it or supports Israeli settler colonialism in Palestine. So they're both hypocrites. And rather than calling for a ceasefire, the resolution had weasel words that the U.S. insisted on to create the conditions for a sustainable cessation of hostilities, which means, you know, down the road, we'll stop this war. And among the changes the U.S. insisted on was that Israel and not the U.N. Will control the aid deliveries. But as Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the U.N., pointed out, aid delivery requires staff who can work in safety, have the logistical capacity, and will support the resumption of commercial activity, so that things can get back to normal with that humanitarian aid. And the UN has a capacity. The Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, doesn't. And they won't ensure that the aid gets to those who need it while they're conducting a war. So it's very problematic. And the US is still supporting Israel's war nearly unconditionally. Now we get reports that Biden administration officials are expressing reservations about Israel's overkill in its attack on Hamas that has so many civilian casualties, but they're doing that behind closed doors. And they're doing it because Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza is alienating the whole world from Israel's prime military and diplomatic support of the United States. But, you know, the question is, will the U.S. really push this? And, you know, there's speculation that the Biden administration will, but then you got the problem of Congress. And as Ralph Nader pointed out in his column this week, You know, Biden could break with traditional U.S. policy of unconditional support for Israel and catch hell from Congress, where 90% of the Democrats and Republicans alike would attack him for that. AIPAC and the rest of the Israeli lobby are constantly lobbying Congress. I mean, they have a real operation, and they make lots of large donations to the politicians who then toe their line. So we have to put the pressure on Congress as well as make demands on the Biden administration. Now is a good time because these people are back in their home districts for the holidays. And we need to tell them we want a ceasefire and then, you know, the U.S. putting the pressure on Israel to get into a peace process. And that, you know, the U.S. has the military and economic leverage over Israel, and that includes BDS measures if necessary to force it into a peace process. And that's, I think, what we got to push. Meanwhile, you know, the death and destruction in Gaza is just, it's just so hard to witness. You know, it's not just the bombing, it's the starvation, it's the disease, it's just the extreme cruelty that's got, we got to stop. So I hope you all will, you know, do what you can to talk to your congressional delegation, get out on the streets. There, you know, demonstrations going all the time. We got to keep pushing on that. The other thing I want to talk about is, you know, the Republicans are whipping up fear about an quote unquote invasion of immigrants. And I want to put that in context because that's not what's happening. But the US and Europe are adopting racist and xenophobic immigration policies that are cruel, immoral, and actually hurt the rich countries that need these immigrants for their labor because the US and Europe are aging. And, you know, there won't be enough labor to support the seniors. And a lot, you know, some industries are short of labor. So there are good reasons to encourage immigration. It's not an invasion. It's an opportunity for the United States. Now, in the world today, there are 280 million migrants, which is about approaching the size of the United States population. It's about 3% of the world's population. About 60% of these people migrate voluntarily. There's usually not a lot of drama involved. But about 40%, which is significant, about 110 million, are forcibly displaced, mostly by wars, but also by genocide, like we've seen with the Rohingya expelled from Myanmar to Bangladesh. You know, there's just a lot going on. Same thing going on in Sudan right now. But contrary to the xenophobic politicians of the world like Donald Trump, these numbers have been pretty constant since in the post-World War II period. The share of the world's population who now live outside their country of birth is 3.6%. In 1960, it was 3.1%. So it hasn't changed that much. What has changed is the share of forcibly displaced people in the world's population, which has more than doubled since 2012. Then it was 0.6%. And by 2022, it was 1.4%. And that reflects these, you know, terrible wars we've had in Afghanistan, Syria, Congo, Ukraine, and now Sudan. But that, you know, that share of 1.4% is still about half of what it was in the aftermath of the Second World War. So we've been in worse situations. And the root cause of this forced displacement and refugees is really the capitalist system. It's an exploitation and imperialist expansion, which creates the climate crisis, endless growth, and burning of fossil fuels, and imperialist wars that the ruling classes of the imperialist powers use to support repressive regimes that keep labor and resources cheap and unregulated. So we need eco-socialist system change to get to the root causes of mass migrations. And this global crisis is going to get worse with climate change, which will also likely generate resource wars for fertile lands, for water, as well as the mineral resources that industry needs, particularly the renewable industry, these rare earth minerals. And the crisis is really more political than demographic. The far right is growing in Europe, in the United States, in the rich countries. on the basis of scapegoating immigrants for social problems that are caused by the normal operation of capitalism. And the political center, like the Democrats in this country and their counterparts in Europe, are pandering to the far right ahead of the 2024 elections in the US and Europe. The far right's been growing in recent elections. So rather than fighting them, the center is accommodating them. And the left is largely silent, with the notable and striking exception of the Green parties in Europe, who have been very pro-immigrant. But the other parties in the center and on the left are either silent, and they're certainly not resisting xenophobic anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies, because they're afraid that sentiment is growing. The right is whipping it up. And I think what we need to realize is that closed borders enforce global economic apartheid. Capital can move to cheap countries, but labor can't move to rich countries to get good wages. So these borders create walls of separation, apartheid, between the rich and the poor. And so now we got, you know, the rich countries in Europe and North America setting themselves up as fortresses against immigrants, which they actually need for their labor. By one estimate, you know, one study found that if we had completely open borders in the world and free movement, it would double global GDP. Immigrants, you know, in this country, we know the statistics show that they commit crimes much less than native-born Americans. A lot of them are entrepreneurial. They start businesses. A lot of them are willing to work in difficult industries that native-born Americans are not: agriculture, meatpacking, construction. So, you know, they're really an asset that should be embraced, not an invasion that we need to repel. So I think what we need to be supporting is more open borders and the social services to support migrants. And what that really means in terms of the ethics is we need to support freedom of movement as a human right, as well as the meeting of people's basic material needs as a human right. And what where we're at now in the US is the Democrats are ready to gut asylum protections and carry out mass deportations in exchange for getting military aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. It's a dirty deal, but the hard right Republicans are insisting on it, and the Democrats are accommodating them. And this is a violation of U.S. law and international law, the United Nations, which gives anyone the right to seek asylum who fears persecution in their home country because of their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or their political opinions. And that's why a lot of people are coming to the United States. Yes, they're economic migrants, and they can be assets, like I said, but to deny asylum is just cruel. It's not just illegal, it's cruel, and makes the U.S. a hypocritical state that proclaims support for human rights, but crushes them in practice. You know, the inscription on the Statue of Liberty says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Yeah, well, if this stuff passes, the U.S. might as well send the statue back to France. And the U.S. here is setting a bad example for Europe, where they are tightening up their borders. And, you know, it's right to give aid to Ukraine and Taiwan for their self-defense. The aid to Israel is unconscionable as it commits genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. But, you know, linking these things is the problem. And it seems Biden and the Democrats are willing to bow to Republican demands to continue the worst policies, and in some cases expand the worst policies of the Trump administration on immigration. And, you know, as a result of these changes there may pass, immigrant families who have been here for years, even decades, could be rounded up and deported or split up, and those that don't have the documentation will be deported. And what we're doing here, ironically, given what's going on in Israel, Palestine, is we're reviving the same kind of racist exclusionary policies on immigration that denied asylum to Jews fleeing Hitler's Holocaust. I mean, that's really the, you know, the immorality of these policies. In the EU, they're reducing immigration and increasing deportations. France just adopted an anti-immigrant bill. Britain has this harebrained scheme to deport immigrants to Rwanda. And, you know, Brexit was all about, really all about getting the UK out of the EU's open border policy. It was an anti-immigrant Brexit or exit from the EU. And immigration is, you know, a hot issue in Europe with many Ukrainians fleeing the Russian invasion, Hong Kongers fleeing China's anti-democratic repression there. So the UK has already paid $300 million to Rwanda to take refugees, but Rwanda only has facilities set up for a few hundred. Denmark is also setting up an agreement with Rwanda, but they haven't sent any immigrants there. Israel also is planning to deport Sudanese and Eritrean asylum seekers to Rwanda, although their Supreme Court overruled it because Rwanda had not kept their side of the deal. So that could be corrected. So, you know, and what's going on in Rwanda? Well, their leader, Paul Kagame, just wants the money from these deals. Kagame, of course, says he's doing humanitarian and human rights work here, but that's hard to believe given his military has been intervening in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo for its mineral and timber resources. And in that conflict, which has been going on for about 30 years, 6 million people have died and 7 million people now are internally displaced. So Rwanda can hardly be described as a free society with a functioning rule of law. There's severe political repression, including arbitrary arrest, a politicized judiciary, and the execution of opponents abroad in the recent past. It's not just Russia that does that. Now, the Democratic Green Party there is opposed to this deal with Britain. Their vice presidential candidate was beheaded in the 2010 election. So they've faced repression. And what the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda is saying is that the rich countries, including the UK, should not shift their international obligation to receive refugees under international law and transfer that responsibility to third countries just because they have the money to influence these countries and enforce their will. And I plan to have the presidential candidate in 2024 of the Green Party in Rwanda. He's a member of Rwanda's parliament. His name is Frank Habineza, on the podcast soon to talk about these issues. Now, he and another member of the Green Party were the first two opposition members to be elected to the parliament in Rwanda since Kagame's Rwanda Patriotic Front took power after the 1994 genocide. So, you know, they are the sole opposition party that has some little bit of power in the Rwandan state, and they're trying to gain more in this election coming up. And, you know, the immigration issue is one of the issues on the table in that election. You know, the Europeans are struggling with labor shortages even more than the U.S. is. But instead, the EU is reinforcing its borders with drones and cameras instead of saving lives of people drowning in the sea. Thousands die each year attempting to reach Europe across the Mediterranean Sea. And just to point to a couple of other places where this is going on, Pakistan is trying to expel 1 million Afghan refugees. Tunisia has been pushing immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa back into the Sahara Desert. So, you know, as I've been saying here, you know, mass migration is a global problem that the right is using to take power by dividing and conquering the popular classes. And the left needs to fight for an alternative based on open borders, providing for migrants' material needs, and ultimately replacing the capitalist system that's at the root of this problem with an eco-socialist alternative. So this is going to become a bigger problem with climate change making areas uninhabitable, We're already seeing that in Africa and the Middle East and in Central America. I mean, it gets so hot there. I saw one statistic that like one third of Salvadoran farm workers have kidney damage from, you know, dehydration and humidity and heat when they work out in the fields or the plantations. So, you know, this is a problem we've got to face and got to come up with a policy, or else we're opening the door to, you know, this right-wing, fascistic, xenophobic, power that is growing. And the last thing I'll say before we open this up is, you know, I have been talking a lot on these podcasts about the growing movement for ranked choice voting and proportional representation and why the Greens need to make it a priority. And one indication of its growing support is that journalistic and academic influencers are advocating it more and more. And I just wanted to share two indications of this. One is a Washington Post article that was published on Thursday by Dan Baltz, which lists a lot of the reforms people are fighting for. Not all of them in there I support, like the nonpartisan primaries, top five, you know, go on to a ranked choice general election. I think that's undermines parties' ability to make their own nominations. We can talk more about that if people want. And the other indication is that the journal Democracy just published a special issue on proportional representation that you can read online, and we'll put the link in the chat for that too. It's a symposium called For a Better Democracy, Proportional Representation. So this is an issue, and I think we need to strike while the iron is hot. We've had 27 straight victories on ranked choice voting ballot initiatives and referendums. And it's going to be on the ballot a lot in many states in 2024. And we need to get it on more states, more cities, and eventually, and hopefully not too long, at the federal level. So I'll stop there and look for your questions and comments. We need critical thinking. I think the message needs to get out of the importance of registering green and voting green in the presidential primary, because both the things, registering green and voting green, help funding and get to the debates, correct? Well, funding, you know, the voting and registering, anybody can contribute. I mean, I think Jill Stein is the one candidate that's running for the Green nomination that has a realistic chance of qualifying for presidential primary matching funds. She will need to raise at least $5,000 in 20 states from contributions of $250 or less, if I remember right. I think it's $250 or less. Maybe it's $200 or less. Anyway, small contributions, small in the, you know, larger scheme of things. They're good sized contributions for Greens. So anybody, you know, anybody, they don't have to be in, it doesn't matter what their party is, they can make those donations to the Stein campaign. Although, of course, registering Green, you know, gets you into the thinking about the Green Party and voting in the primary. I can't think of any states, I can't think of any states where it's possible to register by party, which is all but, I think, 19 of the states. You have to be registered in the party to vote in that party's primary. There are other states where they have what are called open primaries. And I guess in some states, I think New Hampshire may be one, you can switch at the primary polling place and just say, I may be registered as a Democrat or whatever, but this time I want to vote in a Republican primary. And they'll let you do that in New Hampshire. So every state is different. You know, the vote we get in the primary doesn't matter. And most of our primaries are going to be internally organized by Green parties because we're not on the ballot as a major party, so the state will run a primary. I think California will do one. Washington, D.C. will do one. I'm not sure if we have any other states where we'll have a green primary on the ballot. There may be some, I just don't know. In most states, it'll be members of the Green Party. And in that case, you have to either be registered with the state where that's possible, and then you're qualified to vote in that primary that the Green Party will operate, or you have to tell the Green Party you're a Green Party member so you'll get a ballot. But that doesn't affect funding. The thing that the votes that affect funding are the general election votes. And in the general election, there's a public funding system where major parties, which means 25% or more of the vote in the last presidential election, qualify for a public funding grant for basically the fall, you know, from Labor Day on. And in 2020, it was a little over $100 million. Now, neither of the major parties took that because they were raising billions. And if you take that $100 million, you can't raise private money. The last candidate to do that was John McCain in 2008. Obama said he would use the public funding, but then he was raising so much money, he said, oh, I'll change. Never mind, I'm going to take all that private money. So he was well-funded. And since then, the major party candidates have just ignored that. In fact, the Democrats had a bill to eliminate that public funding system. That was H.R. 1. Had a lot of good, you know, voting rights kind of reforms in it, but this was not progressive to eliminate the public funding. And also increase the primary matching funds qualifications, basically fivefold, which would have put it out of the reach of all but the most, you know, the best organized green campaigns. You know, maybe Nader would have done it. I don't think Stein or, you know, me would have done it in, you know, 2012, 2016, or 2020, if it was five times what we have to get now. In any case, the vote that counts is that general election. If you get 5% or more, you get a prorated portion of that full grant that starts at 25%. So if you just got 5%, that's a fifth of, you know, 25%. So Greens will get 20% of the full grant, which in 2020 was about $100 million. So that'd be $20 million for the Greens. If we got 10%, that would be $40 million. So that's where the vote affects funding. And, you know, that's a, you know, getting 5% would really be significant. We've never done it. The best we've ever done was Ralph Nader in 2000, 2.74%. So people get, you know, I guess don't get your hopes too high, but doesn't mean we don't try for that 5%. So that's a long-winded answer to say that anybody can contribute to the Green candidate for presidential primary matching funds. And the vote that counts for getting public funding is that general election vote. And if we get 5% or more, we'll get millions of dollars in public funding for the next presidential election. Steve Welser, wouldn't full freedom of movement have meant Zionists would have flooded into Palestine in even larger numbers and encroached upon the Palestinian community even more? Well, Israel gives Jews full freedom of movement, or, you know, they can go into Israel and they have a special status to enable that. So I don't think it would have increased the number of settlers. And some of them, you know, were not settlers so much as refugees from the Arab countries that started expelling Jews in North Africa and the Middle East after the Israeli state was set up. So I don't think, you know, freedom of movement, Jews already have that to Israel. The problem is Palestinians don't. Palestinian refugees who are exiled from Israel-Palestine can't go back to inside the Green Line that Israel controls, that they were expelled in either 1948, the Nakba, or the 1967 war. So they should have freedom of movement too, the Palestinians. Frankie Lee, Howie, why don't we get our carrier groups out of the Eastern Mediterranean before our troops get killed for nothing? Well, you know, the U.S. is showing force, showing support for Israel, and also there in case the war becomes a regional war, you know, and Iran's proxies, Hezbollah, their militias in Syria and in Iraq, and the Houthis in Yemen, you know, turn into a regional war attacking Israel. So the U.S. is there to, you know, fight them if that happens. But, you know, our carrier groups are just outside all areas of potential conflict, you know, in many places around the world. I think a lot of them could be brought home to the United States. We have, you know, a bigger Navy than we need. It's more there to support, you know, U.S. imperialism to make the world safe for U.S.-based multinational corporations, basically, than it is to do, you know, peace and security missions. The U.S. does a little bit of that. You know, we're still part of the Suez peacekeeping force that's been there since 1956. That was a case where actually the UN General Assembly used the Uniting for Peace resolution to bypass the Security Council. Because what happened in 1956 was Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt to take control of the Suez Canal. And Eisenhower said, no, you don't. The Russians said, no, you don't. And they couldn't get it through the Security Council, so they took it to the General Assembly, which authorized this peacekeeping force. And, you know, Eisenhower basically told Israel, you want our support, you're going to withdraw. And the same to Britain and France. You know, the U.S. really pulled its weight on that one and stopped that invasion. And the peacekeeping force has been there ever since, and there's a U.S. contingent in it. So that's an example of where, you know, our armed forces can be used for peacekeeping. You know, I would argue, too, that when the Islamic State was committing genocide against the Yazidis and Iraq asked the U.S. to help save the Yazidis, and what we did was provide intelligence and air support for, it was actually Syrian Kurds who went in there and escorted these people off of Sinjar Mountain, these Yazidis. You know, the Islamic State was killing the men and boys and enslaving the women, you know, as sex slaves and domestic servants. And it was genocide. And so, you know, the U.S., maybe not for all the highest reasons, but certainly, you know, the Islamic State was a threat to security, you know, and what it was doing to the Yazidis was wrong. So that was, you know, I think a righteous mission for the U.S. Armed Forces. But those are the exceptions. I mean, most of the time we get involved in these, you know, aggressive wars of conquest, you know, from Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan. Or, you know, we just create chaos like we did in Libya and Iraq. So I guess I'm saying is, yeah, the U.S. is, when we say we, you know, there's we in the peace movement, and then there's the we United States. The United States is not going to pull those carrier groups out of the Eastern Mediterranean until this war settles down. I think that's why they're going to stay. You know, I think what we should be saying in the peace movement is, you know, pull them back. They're provocative. And we have so many military capabilities that if, you know, Iran was to, you know, push a war with Israel, you know, we'd have plenty of ways of responding immediately without those carrier groups being right there. We need critical thinking. I heard in 2016, so many people voted for Bernie in some states in the primary that the Greens almost lost their ballot access. It wasn't about the voting. It was about people changing their registration from Green to Democrats so they could vote in the Democratic primary for Bernie Sanders. And California was a party that didn't come real close, but they you know, lost a substantial number of people I know we lost some here, right here in Syracuse and in New York. People who said they would come back to the Greens after the primary, many of them did not. I think the most prominent example of that is Gail McLaughlin, who was the Green mayor of Richmond, California. And she wrote a letter to Greens saying, join me in temporarily becoming a Democrat to vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary, and then we'll go back to the Green Party. Well, she never came back. Bernie, I know in 2016, his campaign was calling Greens in New York. I got one of the calls, and they were urging us to re-register as Greens to vote for Bernie Sanders. And I had choice words for the caller, but that was an effort going on in 2016. I don't think any Green parties lost their ballot status because of that. I think in California, it was probably had the biggest impact because it did take a pretty substantial dent out of the Green. And California is one of those states where if you maintain a minimum number of people registered in the Green Party, you have a ballot line. And I forget the number. It's like it changes because of the overall, voter registration, but it's something like 70,000, 100,000, and the Greens, maybe have 30,000 more than they need, but that's kind of too close for comfort. So, hopefully we'll steadily recover that registration. With Genocide Joe being so close to Israel right now, there's a lot of alienated people who are coming to the Green Party. So maybe those registration numbers will go back up in California and other states. Emil Sachs, under a privatized healthcare system, just birthing a baby costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't know about the cost of the medical costs of birthing a baby. That may be what the hospital charges, but insurance should cover that, whether it's private or public insurance. The problem is the costs of healthcare are about a third more than they need to be because we have hundreds of plans, private and public. And when a provider wants to provide a service like, birthing a baby, they charge a fee to the insurance company. First, they got to find out if the insurance company covering this mother has a covers birth, or whatever the service is. And then, if they do, then they bill the insurance company. And a lot of these insurance companies, systematically just reject haggle over the price and will pay a lower price than the provider is asking. So they have to negotiate on the price. And then sometimes they'll just say, your paperwork's wrong. We're not going to honor this fee for a service. And then the provider has to argue back. So it just creates a whole layer of bureaucrats and paperwork that adds about a third more to the cost of our healthcare system. Which is, one of the advantages of a single public payer, a single payer system. It's very simple. The system covers, certain services, and there's a price, and that's what the provider asks, and that's what the payer pays. And there's not a lot of back and forth. So the overhead for Medicare is like 2 or 3%. And for private insurance, it's around 30-35%. So that's why we got a mixed system of private and public. And it's very confusing. And even the public system is getting privatized. So Medicare doesn't cover drugs, doesn't cover some services, doesn't cover hearing, dental, eyes. So people buy Medicare Advantage plans, which take over the administration of the whole all services, and they get paid by Medicare, and then they're on their own. And so the hospitals are fighting with the private Medicare Advantage plans to get paid. There's also, you can pay for a Medicare supplement or Medigap, which leaves you in traditional Medicare for the services it covers, but for the others, you buy a Medigap plan, plus it covers the extra 20% that isn't covered by Medicare for most services. Those are private insurance companies. And then even the VA, which is a, national health service model where the hospitals and the doctors are public Public-owned hospitals, publicly employed doctors and nurses and healthcare providers. And even there, they are moving to contract out services. So I forget the number now, but it's a significant percentage, something like a third of all doctor's visits that veterans have are with private healthcare organizations that the VA outsources to. And this is part of the whole neoliberal move. The head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, now appointed by Biden, is Liz Fowler, a former health insurance company executive and lawyer who was a principal author of Obamacare, which was basically the Republican plan, employer mandates for private health insurance, and then expansion of Medicaid for the poor, which turned out to be optional under Obamacare. So a lot of states didn't take it up. It left the funding locally. That was we basically had three healthcare reforms coming out of the 70s when healthcare inflation was a big issue and the fact that Medicaid and Medicare still left about a sixth of the population uncovered. So they were looking for an alternative. And there was a conservative plan that was Nixon's, which is the healthcare mandates. But his expansion of Medicaid, he gave it a new name. They federalized the funding. Now it's a mix between state and federal. So a lot of the conservative states, in the South just said, we're not taking the Medicare expansion offered by Obamacare because it paid all of it for a few years. And then the state had to kick in half like it does with traditional Medicaid. So a lot of states didn't take it. So that was much more conservative than what Nixon offered, which he offered a much more generous and federalized healthcare system for the poor who weren't employed. So you had that plan. You had national health insurance. That was Kennedy. That's what we call Medicare for All. And then you had the Dellums plan, which is a national health service that was democratically structured, community controlled. So you would have community health boards elected two-thirds by the public that used the community health center in that neighborhood and one-third by the healthcare workers in that district. So every community of 25 to 50,000 would have a community health center and a local health board. And in turn, those boards would appoint two consumers and one worker to a district board, which would basically be at the general hospital level, and then a regional board, which is the medical center where you had very specialized services and medical education, and from there to the national level. So it was a bottom-up, democratically controlled national health service. And that's what we need, given that not just health insurance, but the doctors and hospitals are increasingly corporatized. And from the pharmacies to the funeral director, long-term elder care, you name it, the whole healthcare system has been corporatized, monopolized, and the prices are going up and the service is going down. So even people who were pushing for Medicare for All, like Physicians for a National Health Program, number of their leading physicians had an article in The Nation, May 31st, 2022, March 31st, 2022, I believe, called Medicare for All is Not Enough. Subtitle was, Community, Not Corporations, Should Own Healthcare Assets. So we're moving back to that Dellums model, which Dellums he introduced it in 1977. He kept introducing it till he left in 1997. His successor, Barbara Lee, reintroduced it, but then the second time she reintroduced it, she gutted the democratic structure in it. So we really need to go back to the Dellums bill, not what Barbara Lee had gutted. When she reintroduced it several more times until Obamacare passed, then she stopped as if we were done. And now we need that bill back in Congress. And where's the squad? Where are the progressives? They don't even have a good Medicare for All bill. Even the J-Paul bill is a step back from H.R. 676 in the amount of private management and contracting that that national health insurance plan, Medicare for All, she calls it, would allow. So, the healthcare field is where, that's why we need the damn Green Party, because even the progressive Democrats have really not fought for a good single-payer system, which now should be a health service, not just health insurance. Frankie Lee, Howie, shouldn't we be trying to make necessities public instead of private? I think, yeah, in most respects. I mean, let's think about them. What are we talking about? Healthcare, education, a senior pension, Social Security. And then I think there are areas, you know, and those should be just, you know, free. You go to school, and that should be expanded to include childcare, preschool, and continuing education, college and continuing education at public institutions. That needs to be expanded. We've talked about how to expand healthcare. And then there are areas like housing, where I don't think we want the whole housing stock to be public, but we do want a great expansion of public housing and improvement of the quality of public housing. So there's enough public housing so that everybody has an option for affordable care, and public housing scales your rent to your ability to pay. And we can make those mixed incomes, so the higher income people help subsidize the lower income people within the project, which makes it much more viable to do public housing. That's what they do in Europe. It doesn't create, you know, concentrated poverty in housing projects. It creates, you know, a mix of people there so that the poor aren't concentrated and segregated. So that's housing. What else? Transportation. I don't think we want to, you know, have the whole car fleet be public, but we do want to expand public transportation. And I would say make intra-city public transit free. It incentivizes people to get on public transit and reduces the need or the incentive to use a personal vehicle. And if we build out a real good intra-city public transportation system, that's convenient. It's more convenient than getting in the car, maintaining it. It's expensive. You got to pay for parking. If you can get on convenient public transportation and get to where you need to go quickly and conveniently, that's what we need to be aiming for. So I would say a lot more public ownership in transportation sector, the rails. I think we should socialize the whole railroad system, take the freight rails away from, you know, the Warren Buffett's of the world that own these big railroad companies, and, you know, they're reducing staffing, which is a safety problem, and they're not keeping the rail infrastructure, you know, up in tip-top shape. So that should be public, electrified instead of fossil fueled. And then we need to build high-speed rail between the cities. So that becomes a much more energy and resource-efficient way, and often a faster way of getting between cities than getting on a short commuter flight. And I don't think these things will happen unless we have a public transportation corporation, maybe a federated model like the healthcare system I described, where you have, you know, metropolitan transportation authorities, publicly elected, and then they federate at, you know, larger levels to go to the national level. But I don't think that'll happen if it's, you know, the private profit motive in the market. We have what we have now, which is a terrible railroad system. It's deteriorated. We don't have good public transportation. High-speed rail is something that's talked about, but we're basically, you know, public invest, but it's privately only, so-called public-private partnerships, where the public pays and the private profits. So, yeah, we need a lot more public enterprise and service delivery than we have now. Now, take food. I don't think we want to, you know, put the farmers on collective farms and things like that. I think we need to support them with parity pricing and supply management so they're guaranteed a living income. And then the food distribution system, hopefully a lot of cooperatives between the farmers for the food processing and marketing. And then at the delivery side, hopefully more cooperative grocery stores. The cooperatives are private enterprises. They are just democratic, unlike you know, capitalist corporations. And then, you know, restaurants. I don't want to see, you know, the state providing food. I mean, it would be like, you know, military cafeteria food or, you know, school food that's, that, you know, in the worst schools. On the other hand, I would like to see antitrust so that these chains, these fast food chains, don't dominate the restaurant business. And so you have more opportunity for local, you know, people that want to, you know, they're people that like to run restaurants. They like to cook. They like to serve people. And it's a very different atmosphere when you have a mom and pop restaurant than you do with a fast food chain. So I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, we need more public, but it doesn't need to be all public. There's plenty of room for, you know, private enterprise in, you know, some areas like food, part of the housing market. If we have a big enough public sector in housing, that's going to set a yardstick for rents in the private sector. Otherwise, you know, if you charge too much in the private sector, people are going to be going for those public units. So that will level the prices in the private market. So that's my answer. Steve Welser, Mearsheimer advised Ukrainians not to listen to the siren song of U.S. advice about NATO membership. You disparage his realism. But unrealism has led to wrecking of the place, as he predicted. Mearsheimer, you know, advised Ukraine and Kazakhstan and Belarus to keep their nuclear weapons. In fact, he said more European countries should have nuclear weapons. This is back in 1994. The Budapest Memorandum is what was the agreement between Ukraine and Kazakhstan and Belarus with Russia, the UK, and the US. And those countries gave up their nukes they inherited from the Soviet Union in return for guarantees from Russia, as well as the UK and US, that their sovereignty and territorial integrity would be protected. And it didn't happen. You know, Mearsheimer is what is called a realist, and he believes that great powers deserve spheres of influence. And his position is that Ukraine is in Russia's spheres of influence. So, you know, that's the way it should be. The Ukrainians' self-determination, their rights are like, small countries are out of luck. It's the big powers that rule in their spheres of influence. That's the same kind of position that Kissinger had. And I don't think that's conducive to peace and security, human rights, or democracy. So, you know, the fact is Russia invaded Ukraine, is doing settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing. If you don't agree to take a Russian passport, if you're in an occupied territory, you're in trouble. At best, you'll be denied services. They will take your passport from you so you can't go anywhere. At worst, you'll be detained, tortured, maybe killed, you disappear, or expelled to Russia, which has happened to millions of people, including, we don't know how many children. The Russian leadership, the woman that's in charge of the Children's Bureau, whatever, she's under an International Criminal Court warrant for arrest, says they've got 700,000 Ukrainian children. The Ukrainians have the names of 20,000 of them. So we don't know what the real number is, but that's genocide. You know, they call Ukrainian a mongrel language. They don't know how to really speak Russian. You know, they're so disparaging to the Ukrainians. And that's the occupation, but Mearsheimer's fine with that. He wants to, you know, just have a ceasefire and let the Russians keep what they've stolen. And to hell with the people that are getting, you know, repressed inside the occupied territories. So I don't consider Mearsheimer moral or that smart. So, yeah, I disparage his realism. And, you know, the reality is, you know, Russia's an imperialist power in Ukraine and wants its sphere of influence and thinks it has a right to it. And it doesn't recognize the right of peoples to self-determination, which I think any progressive should. So, you know, and we heard Putin in his news conference, you know, his annual news conference saying, you know, their goals haven't changed. Denazification, which means overthrowing the Ukrainian government and killing its leadership and intellectual class. It means demilitarization, which means Russia rules, and neutrality, which means Russia rules. You know, NATO membership was not popular in Ukraine before 2014 when the Russians did their first invasion of the Donbass and Crimea. You know, like a third or 25% wanted NATO membership. And after that first invasion, it went to about 50%. After the full-scale invasion of February 2022, the polls now show it's 97, 98% of Ukrainians want NATO membership because they think that will protect them from Russian aggression. So, you know, Putin wanted to stop NATO membership. Instead, he united NATO and expanded it. Finland and Sweden joined. You know, and Finland's had a history of aggression by Russia in the form of the Soviet Union in the, you know, early 1940s. And they did grab a part of Finland. They didn't get it all. They got defeated, taken it all. But they did take a part of Finland. They pushed the Finns out and settled Russians there. And, you know, Finland has given that part of Russia up that used to be part of Finland. So I also don't believe that, you know, if Ukraine had not taken, you know, sought NATO membership, but still elected people that didn't want to be under the tutelage of Russia, Putin would have still gone in. It wasn't about NATO. You know, he didn't get freaked out when Finland joined NATO. Putin didn't. And, you know, NATO wasn't threatening Russia's security. You know, there were questions that, you know, needed to be discussed, like the placement of anti-ballistic missiles and bases in Poland and Romania, which could be quickly converted to, you know, nuclear missile launch bases. So that was a legitimate concern. You know, they weren't really needed in those countries. They said they were for stopping Iranian missiles headed toward Europe, which, you know, yeah, maybe, but also Russian missiles. And the Russians were concerned that would enable the U.S. to do a first strike, or the West. So there were issues there to discuss. But that should have been diplomacy, not war. You know, what Putin did December 21st, 2021, he issued an ultimatum to NATO. He said, pull back to the NATO footprint, military footprint, at the time Germany reunified. Or else, and or else was 150,000, 200,000 troops amassed on Ukraine's border. And he wanted NATO to do that within a few weeks. NATO, you know, doesn't move that fast. It was not a serious demand. That was to set up a justification for an invasion that there's a lot of reporting shows, you know, Putin had made up his mind to do it well before that. So, you know, I'm Mearsheimer is not, I'm not a fan of Mearsheimer. Amy says, happy holidays. And I guess that's, we're getting toward the end of the hour. So I don't know if there's another question coming or that's, nope, there's the banner. Okay. Well, everybody, yes, have a good, happy holiday. You know, get restored and rested and ready to go in the new year because, you know, we got real issues. You know, whether it's the war in Israel, Palestine, or, you know, we didn't talk about housing, something I should probably talk about soon. We have record numbers of homeless. And that's, you know, what this private housing market is producing. And I know that's, you know, wherever we live, that's an issue. More people out on these streets, you know, freezing in the winter, begging on the corners. We need to take care of people, and we're not. So a lot of issues. So enjoy the holidays. And I'll be here next Saturday, as far as I know. I know there was some question today whether I'd have the backup, but Anna stepped up for Chris, and thank you, Anna. And so I guess we'll see y'all next week. Have a good week.